now move on to session 41, and it's an enormous pleasure for me to introduce our next speaker. Dr. William Jarvis is president of Jason Jarvis Associates. He formerly worked at CDC for 23 years. He's a prolific contributor to the science of infection prevention control with in excess of 450 publications in peer-reviewed journals. He's a former president of the Society for Healthcare Epidemiology of America. And I'm delighted that he's here because he nearly had a near miss with British Rail yesterday and ended up spending the night in Aberdeen. So you're very welcome. It's a bit cooler up there, isn't it?
Yes, thank you very much. Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. I'd like to thank IPS, Mr. Kernan, for the opportunity to speak to you today. I'm going to try to cover a lot of ground by hitting what is hot off the press. I consult for a number of companies. None of them have influenced my presentation at all. What I'm going to try to do today is, first of all, provide an overview of the evidence-based methods for preventing healthcare-associated infections, and then illustrate how applying some of these interventions, particularly when done in bundles, have a dramatic impact on reducing healthcare-associated infections, maybe even to zero. The first is hand hygiene. I've seen a number of posters about hand hygiene. I know you all spend a great deal of your time dealing with hand hygiene. I think hand hygiene is very important, but I also think we need to be realistic. We have antiseptic hand rinses now that make availability of hand hygiene much more accessible, and they're effective against a wide range of organisms, with the exception of spores, particularly C. difficile. However, we have to be realistic. Good luck in getting to and sustaining 100%. I saw some posters suggesting that you have very high rates of, say, 90% compliance, and I would like to go to those hospitals and bet, because I don't believe that's realistic. In fact, I asked Didier Pitté and Stefan Harbath at University of Geneva. Didier is head of the World Health Organization hand hygiene campaign. I asked them, what is the highest rate of hand hygiene compliance that you have been able to sustain? That's with 16 infection control nurses spending almost $100,000 a year, posters on every wall, a huge poster outside the hospital saying do hand hygiene, it saves lives. The highest rate of compliance that they have been able to sustain is 67%. So the likelihood that smaller hospitals with less resources can achieve 100%, I think, is very unlikely. One way to change that is clinician accountability, driven by administrators, and I think this is essential. Infection control is everyone's job, not just your jobs. Observations of hand hygiene compliance are notoriously unpredictable. In fact, I was listening to a discussion of one hand hygiene observation that was done by Elaine Larson and one of her students, and they were debating whether that was a hand hygiene opportunity or not. If the world's experts are debating this, what's the likelihood that the rest of us that aren't that expert are going to do a very good job? I think there is a way to monitor hand hygiene, though, that would be reliable, and that's electronic monitoring, and I think we ultimately will move to that. What about prevention of urinary tract infections? UTIs are the most common source of HAI. Most, 80%, are associated with urinary catheterization. Approximately 25% of all inpatients have a urinary catheter. The attack rate is about 2 to 3 UTIs per 100 admissions. One of the problems is we have many clinicians who catheterize patients almost willy-nilly. If we look at the appropriate indications, as shown here on the right side of this slide, left side, it's bladder outlet obstruction, incontinence with a sacral wound, urine output monitoring, patients' requests, such as at the end of life, and during or just after some, not all, some surgical procedures. In fact, if you look at the CDC guideline that's just been revised and put out for public comment, they had a group of experts say what were the appropriate indications for urinary catheterization, and the list is not a whole lot different than this. The problem is, as a study shown by Jan and colleagues published in 1995, when you look at initial colonization, only 20% of them met these criteria. Patient days, almost 50% of the patient days of urinary catheterization were not consistent with these recommendations. Another problem is not just used appropriately, but perhaps physicians, as hard as it is to believe, forget the patient has a urinary catheter. Well, Sanjay Saint and colleagues did a study looking at that, where they did a survey of 56 medical teams at four different sites, had about 256 providers, had a very high completion rate of almost 89%. What they found was that medical students were unaware that their own patients had a urinary catheter almost 20% of the time. Interns, 22% of the time. Residents, 28% of the time. And attending physicians, almost 40% of the time, did not even know their patient had a urinary catheter. Sanjay Saint called this catheters lost in place. And that has led to the possibility of using what's called a urinary catheter reminder. It reminds our physicians that the patient does have a urinary catheter and makes them override to keep that catheter in by indicating, as shown here, that they actually have one of the reasons that I mentioned before for that catheter to remain in place. Another possibility is called the silver bullet or silver impregnated urinary catheters. Silver has in vitro antibacterial activity. It's been shown in a meta-analysis and randomized controlled trials to prevent UTIs. Cost is about $5, although the dollar is going down, so it may be worth a lot more. In the reduction of catheter-associated UTIs, the question has been, is it worth the cost? There's one meta-analysis, Cochrane database, systemic review by Brosnahan and colleagues, where they look both at asymptomatic as well as symptomatic UTIs. This is symptomatic UTI here, and as you can see, there was a significant decrease in catheter-associated UTI through the use of silver impregnated catheters, particularly silver alloy hydrogel catheters. To date, there have been 11 comparative studies and two meta-analyses of silver, the majority of them being silver alloy, versus non-coated Foley catheters. In every one of those comparative trials, the number of catheter-associated UTIs has been decreased in the impregnated group. In some of those studies, the numbers are relatively small, and as a result, they did not reach statistical significance. Nevertheless, in every single one of those studies, and you would say, if this is just due to chance, it should be 50-50, and it's not. Every one of them, the rate of catheter-associated UTIs, either as UTIs or asymptomatic bacteria, has decreased. In both meta-analyses, combining a variety of studies to increase the power to detect a difference, the authors have concluded that silver alloy-coated catheters associated with a significant reduction in catheter-associated UTI in asymptomatic bacteria. And these data support the use of such catheters in patients who are going to have urinary catheterization for 3 to 7 days. So to produce catheter-associated UTIs, again, a bundle is necessary, using urethral catheters only when necessary, using aseptic technique for catheter insertion, maintaining a closed urinary drainage system, requiring urinary catheter insertion indication or order, and considering the use of an administrative stop order, particularly in our surgical patients, to limit inappropriate catheterization, and then in higher-risk patients with longer-term catheterization, the consideration of silver alloy impregnated catheters. What about central venous catheter bloodstream infections, or CVC BSIs, or central line-associated BSIs? We know they have a tremendous impact on our patient. Crude mortality of all patients who have an intravenous catheter is about 10 to 40%. When we control severity of illness and underlying disease, it's about 2 to 15%. These prolong hospital stay by 5 to 20 days, and that's the major driver for healthcare costs in most countries. And at least through a variety of studies in the United States, the cost, the attributable cost, is somewhere between $34,000 and $60,000. In fact, I was in New York City about 2 weeks ago, and I asked them how much it costs. And today in New York City, the cost of a central venous catheter bloodstream infection is $90,000 per episode. If we think of the pathophysiology of catheter-related infections, first of all, we need to keep in mind it's not like the old days when our patients might have had one central venous line. Now they oftentimes have 2 to 4 central venous catheters. The catheter itself may be the source of infection. The skin or the dressing can be the source. The hub, the line, the connectors can be the source. You can have hematogenous spread from another site, or you can have either intrinsic or more commonly extrinsic contamination of infusates and drugs. Obviously, our prevention interventions have to be aimed at all of these potential sources for infection. The first way to prevent these is to not put a catheter in. Next is to choose the lowest risk catheter. How many of you have clinicians that put the same catheter in every patient? In the United States, every anesthesiologist I know puts in an internal jugular line, usually a multi-lumen catheter, every patient, regardless of what the catheter is in there for. And they don't consider using a peripheral IV if you don't really need a central venous catheter, or using a peripherally inserted central catheter, PICC, or a tunneled cuffed CVC rather than a percutaneous CVC for long-term access. And then obviously getting the catheter out reduces the risk for infection. We have a variety of recommendations in the United States. This is one of the documents from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, but realize this document was published in 2002. It was completed in 2000, so it's literally a decade old and is currently being revised. More recently, in October of last year, a group of organizations, including the Association for Professionals in Infection Control, the Society for Healthcare Epidemiology of America, the Joint Commission that accredits our hospitals, the American Hospital Association, got together and published this document, Strategies to Prevent Central Line Associated Bloodstream Infections in Acute Care Facilities. It recommends a basic and an advanced approach. The basic approach is to have a catheter checklist. This is like our pilots out at Heathrow or Leeds Airport, where every pilot everywhere in the world has a checklist. And they have to go through that checklist of minimum things they must do before they take off. I hear from many of my clinician friends who say, I don't want to be told what to do. Well, too bad. We'll tell you the basics of what you have to do, which you must do. If you want to do more than that, fine, but you cannot do less than that. The checklist lists the things that we say must be done every time. It includes hand hygiene, thinking about your insertion site and trying to avoid femoral or internal jugular, having a kit that has everything you need at the bedside, using a maximal barrier precautions, and chlorhexidine skin prep. This is just one example of a checklist that lists on the far left all the different actions. Next is the level of recommendation. Next is a full description of that intervention. And then last is yes or no, was this done or not? These checklists offer several advantages. The first is if you're in the United States or here in the UK and you have a few cowboys or cowgirls who want to do what they want to do rather than what you tell them they should be doing, you can feed the data back to all of the clinicians, and hopefully if you have one or two outliers, it will drive them into the pack. Second is, as I heard earlier by one of the speakers, doing a risk assessment, or rather a root cause analysis. We're supposed to do that in the United States if we have a central venous catheter bloodstream infection. Well, what happens then? The infection preventionist will come and ask me, what did I do when I inserted that catheter 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 10, 20 days ago? I can barely remember what I did yesterday. So what am I going to tell that person? I'm going to tell them what I should have done, not what I really did. Whereas if you filled this out at the time of catheter insertion, you can pull it out and see whether I did everything I should have done. And if not, it's an opportunity to educate me. Last, you can feed back data to all the clinicians where they can see if here on the left is the physician, the number of insertions, whether they use full barrier precautions, whether they did hand hygiene, whether they use femoral lines, whether they use chlorhexidine, or povidone iodine, et cetera, all the things you want to follow, you feed it back to them so they can see how well they comply with the recommendations. This is just one example of an insertion cart. We're treating the insertion of a catheter as if it's a surgical procedure. You don't see your cardiac surgeons stopping in the middle of a procedure and walking down the hallway because they forgot something. And yet we oftentimes saw that with our inserters of central venous catheters. Use of maximum barrier precautions, where the inserter, again, is treating this like a surgical procedure, wearing cap, gown, mask, gloves, has a kit where everything they need is right there by the bedside, and the patient is covered from head to foot, with the only area open is where they're going to insert that catheter. I know 100 years ago when I trained as an intern and a resident, we didn't do this. And if I was inserting a catheter and the needle or the catheter dropped, what would happen? It would drop on the patient's gown or their bed, and I would pick it up and look around and wipe it off and hook it up. Not exactly sterile technique. One of the points I want to make about maximal bare precautions, if you look at the SHE or the CDC guideline, this is a Category 1A recommendation, the highest level of recommendation that those organizations give out. And yet if you look at the data, that was based on four studies. Only one of them was a randomized controlled trial by Sam Rod and colleagues in cancer at a cancer hospital with less than 600 patients. And I find it interesting the debate that you as well as we are having about MRSA. And I think we hold MRSA to a much higher level than we hold anything else that we do in infection control, because the level of data that we have for MRSA, I think, is much greater than for many other things that we do. I still think this is a very worthwhile thing to do, but it wasn't exactly a Category 1 recommendation based on enormous amount of data. This is a study by Sam Rod and colleagues where they did everything but maximum bare precautions and then introduced maximum bare precautions. And you can see either in yellow here, which is total infection, so early and late infections, as well as infections in the first 2 months thought to be more likely related to insertion than maintenance, were both statistically significantly reduced with maximum bare precautions. Skin prep is very important. Apply for 30 seconds with friction, and then allow it to dry for 30 seconds. Observe your clinicians. Very few of them do that. In fact, very few of them understand that drying of an antiseptic is very important, if you're using povidone iodine or chlorhexidine. There have been a large number of studies looking at use of chlorhexidine with alcohol compared to povidone iodine without alcohol. So there's biases in these studies. And in fact, if you compare chlorhexidine with alcohol to povidone iodine with alcohol, they're really equivalent. But these studies all were with povidone iodine without alcohol. It's a meta-analysis published in Annals of Internal Medicine in 2002 that showed that you had an overall reduction in bloodstream infections by about 50% by using chlorhexidine rather than using povidone iodine, again, without alcohol. What are the special approaches? The use of chlorhexidine baths, use of antiseptic or antimicrobial impregnated catheters, use of a chlorhexidine impregnated disc or biopatch, and use of antimicrobial locks. When should these be applied? Well, these approaches are to be applied when the rates are higher than institutional goals. What is your institutional goal? Well, it should be zero. So what are the data for the use of these? The first is chlorhexidine baths. Been two major studies looking at this. This by Vernon and colleagues, published in Archives of Internal Medicine in 2006, a prospective sequential group, single-arm clinical trial, and they compared soap and water to a 2% chlorhexidine cloth used for bathing or cleaning at a teaching hospital's medical intensive care unit. And they assessed vancomycin-resistant Enterococcus, or VRE, colonization, infection, and contamination. Almost 2,000 patients treated. Chlorhexidine resulted in a 2.5 log reduction in colonies of VRE in the patient's skin, less healthcare worker hand contamination, less environmental contamination, and VRE acquisition decreased from 26 to 9 per 1,000 patient days, and this was statistically significant, about a 60% reduction. Second study by Climo and colleagues, more recent, published in Critical Care Medicine, again, a before-after trial, 6 months of one, 6 months of the other, study of soap and water versus chlorhexidine, daily bathing, and they looked at MRSA and VRE acquisition and bloodstream infections in six different intensive care units at four different academic centers. Chlorhexidine bathing reduced MRSA acquisition, colonization that is, by 32%, VRE acquisition or colonization by 50%, decreased VRE BSIs and VRE BSI and VRE colonized patients, but did not decrease MRSA BSI. This may be due to power. Actually, before I leave that, I just want to point out that I think you all, as well as we, are using a lot of chlorhexidine. And a paper which will come from England, published in Clinical Infectious Diseases within the next several months, is going to show that At least here in the UK, there are some chlorhexidine-resistant strains of MRSA, and I think we need to be very cautious that those may increase in prevalence as more widespread chlorhexidine is being used. What about the use of antiseptic and antimicrobial-containing catheters? This is a meta-analysis by Venestra and colleagues published in JAMA in 1999. It's a little bit of a problem with these in that it's silver-impregnated, chlorhexidine-impregnated, silver-chlorhexidine-impregnated, minocycline rifampin impregnated, all of these different types of catheters compared to non-impregnated. But when they did that and looked at them all, they found that the summary odds ratio was about 0.56, so about a 60% reduction in BSI associated with use of antiseptic or antimicrobial impregnated catheters. A subsequent study by Walder and colleagues published in Infection Control in 2002, where they looked at the same data but then cut it slightly differently and most importantly, looked at short-term catheterization versus long-term catheterization and found that the antiseptic or antimicrobial impregnated catheters significantly reduced BSI with long-term, defined as greater than 1 week, catheterization, but they did not see the benefit with short-term catheterization less than a week. With BSIs, we need to keep in mind the biology, microbiology of the skin. 80% of the resident bacteria exist within the epidermis. 20% is found on the hair follicles and sebaceous glands. So if I invite you up here, I give you a bucket of chlorhexidine and tell you to use antisepsis on my skin for the next 30 minutes to an hour. Contrary to what I read in operative reports, my skin is still not going to be sterile. You're still going to have 20% of those organisms on hair follicles and sebaceous glands. And then those organisms will regrow. So at 18 to 24 hours, they're back to the levels that they were before you applied that skin antiseptic. Furthermore, one of the other reasons why we should give some thought to where we're placing these catheters is that the skin bioburden is different. If we look at the antecubital fossa, if you do a swab of the IV site, plate it out, you can see the colonies here, about 10 to 20 CFU per cubic centimeter. If we then move to the subclavian area, you can see it's 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4th. You can barely see because it's almost too numerous to count. And if we move to the femoral area, you're talking about 10 to the 4th, 10 to the 6th organisms. So where you place that catheter, you're going to have very different bioburdens. This is a summary of a large number of randomized controlled trials. Over 14 randomized controlled trials now looking at this chlorhexidine impregnated sponge or biopatch in a variety of different patient populations, intensive care unit, neonatal intensive care unit, oncology patients, surgical patients, et cetera. All of them have found the same thing, reduction in local site infection, reduction in bloodstream infections, and a reduction in microbial bioburden at the site. I want to highlight two studies that have more recently been published. This first by Rischolte and colleagues from Germany, published in Annals of Hematology, and they ask, if you do everything in the bundle that I mentioned and you're using antiseptic impregnated catheters, is there any additional benefit to adding this chlorhexidine sponge? This was a prospective randomized open-controlled study in cancer chemotherapy patients requiring CVC for more than 5 days. And they were randomized to the CHG sponge or to a standard dressing. They had 600 patients with almost 10,000 CVC days. The mean duration of CVC was almost 17 days. In the treatment group, 16 days in the controls. Mean neutropenia, 7.5 days versus 6.9 days. CVC-related infections were 11.3% in the controls versus 6.3% in the CHG sponge group for a reduction of over 50%. And they argued that the use of the CHG biopatch reduced CVC-related infections by over 50%, even if you were using, in this case, a silver chlorhexidine impregnated catheter. The next study is by Temsit and colleagues published in JAMA in April of this year. This was a large randomized controlled trial in France at a variety of ICUs, medical, surgical, and medical surgical units at university tertiary care as well as non-tertiary care centers. And they really asked two questions. One is, if you change the dressing at 3 days versus 7 days, does it make any difference? And if you use the chlorhexidine impregnated patch or biopatch versus a transparent dressing, does it make any difference? First, I would highlight the fact that their starting BSI rate is right there, 1.3 per 1,000 CBC days. I can tell you there aren't very many ICUs in the United States that at the time of the study had CBC rates that low. So to have a significant impact requires a large study with an intervention that is pretty significant. And in fact, you can see that when they introduced the chlorhexidine impregnated patch, they were able to decrease their BSI rate to 0.4 per 1,000 CBC days. So a 75% reduction in CBC BSIs. Last is the use of antiseptic or antimicrobial locks or flushes. This is a meta-analysis by Stadfar and colleagues published in CID in 2006. Seven different studies, about 500 patients, most of them being cancer, one being neonatal intensive care units. And they found the summary risk ratio for vancomycin heparin lock or flush was about 50%. And they concluded that the use of such a flush would reduce catheter-related bloodstream infections in patients that have long-term intravascular devices. One other area of concern is the issue of connectors. There are a wide variety of different needleless connectors, including lower access split septum, lower access mechanical valves, and lower access mechanical valves with positive pressure or positive displacement. We have had a variety of studies in the United States describing increases in bloodstream infections when they went from split septum to mechanical valve technology. This is a study by Mark Rupp at University of Nebraska, where they changed from split septum to a positive displacement mechanical valve. Their BSI rate in their critical care or transplant unit increased from about 3.9 to over 10. Their nine other inpatient areas from about 3.5 to 7.5. And the winner for the highest rate was a cooperative or outpatient treatment area that increased from about 6 to 15 per 1,000 CBC days. They went back and reviewed, did education, could not get their BSI rate to decrease. They went back to a split septum technology, and as you can see on the far right here, the BSI rates in all three areas significantly decreased, with some of the rates decreasing to below their initial baseline rate. Subsequently, a study by Salgado and colleagues at a long-term acute care facility had the same type of experience where they went from split septum to mechanical valve. Their BSI rate increased by a factor of 3. Their gram-negative infections increased by almost fivefold. They did education, made sure all the bundle was being done, could not get their rate to decrease, and went back to split septum technology, and their BSI rate significantly decreased. This has led the Society for Healthcare Epidemiology and the compendium that I mentioned to you to specifically recommend not to use positive pressure needleless connectors with mechanical valves before a thorough assessment of the risk, benefits, and education regarding their use. We have a multi-center study from the United States and Australia that will be published in December in Clinical Infectious Diseases that found that both positive pressure, positive displacement, and even negative pressure mechanical valves were associated with increased BSI rate even when more enhanced infection control measures were being used. Last, I want to show you that if you use this bundle, you can have tremendous impact. This is a study called the Keystone Project conducted in the state of Michigan, which is kind of the middle, upper north part of our United States, called the Keystone State, where they did an interventional cohort study in 108 different ICUs in the state of Michigan. Did this for over 18 months. They compared compliance with the bundle that I mentioned to you, as well as CVC BSI rates before, during, and after the intervention. A total of 103 ICUs were in the final publication in New England Journal in 2006. Their baseline beginning rate was 2.7 per 1,000 CVC days, which is not that high to even begin with. That's below our national median average. At 3 months, the rate was 0. That means 103 ICUs had 0 BSIs. They unfortunately could not maintain that because they really emphasized the insertion bundle and didn't emphasize quite as much a maintenance bundle, which I think is equally important. And at 16 to 18 months, the rate was 1.4 per 1,000 CBC days, but that was still over a 66% reduction in BSIs in all of these 103 ICUs and hospitals across the state of Michigan. Now this intervention is being unrolled at 10 different states over 3 years, funded by the federal government, at 10 hospitals in each of those states. I personally believe it should be mandated in all ICUs in the United States right now, because we know it will work. What about ventilator-associated pneumonia? It's the most common healthcare-associated infection in critical care patients. Multiple risk factors, including age, chronic obstructive lung disease, trauma, gastric aspiration, duration of ventilation, elevated gastric pH. About 10 to 20% of ventilated patients for more than 48 hours will develop ventilator-associated pneumonia. The bundle of practices is chlorhexidine on the unit, oral care, primarily using chlorhexidine, sedation reduction and sedation vacations, using deep vein thrombosis and peptic ulcer disease prophylaxis, using an aggressive ventilator weaning protocol and continuous aspiration of subglottic secretions. This is a ventilator bundle compliance audit tool similar to the checklist that I showed you for CVC BSIs, where on each day for the patient, this can be checked whether they're getting what they should be getting or not. There are a variety of studies looking at oral decontamination with chlorhexidine. I'm just going to highlight four of them. The study by Coleman and colleagues is a randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial comparing placebo to 2% chlorhexidine versus 2% chlorhexidine and 2% colistin. Compared with the placebo, the risk of ventilator-associated pneumonia was 65%, so a 35% reduction with chlorhexidine, and 55% or a 45% reduction with chlorhexidine and colistin. Both of those were statistically significant. Tadapong published a study where they compared saline with 4 times a day use of chlorhexidine and also did a meta-analysis, and they found that the overall risk reduction of ventilator-associated pneumonia in the chlorhexidine group was about 0.53, and this was statistically significant. Another study by Sona and colleagues, it's a pre-post intervention observational study. The intervention is cleaning teeth with sodium monofluorophosphate paste and brush, rinse with water, and then applying a 0.12% chlorhexidine solution twice per day. Compared with pre-intervention, the ventilator-associated pneumonia rate was cut by about 50% from 5.2 to 2.4%. And then lastly, a study by Chan and colleagues published in BMJ, a systematic review and meta-analysis of 11 different trials over 3,000 patients, found oral antibiotics had no significant impact on reducing ventilator-associated pneumonia, whereas oral antiseptic, particularly chlorhexidine, had a significant reduction of about 50%. This is an example of one hospital. In blue is shown the ventilator-associated pneumonia rate. Red is compliance with the ventilator-associated pneumonia bundle that I showed you. And as they get to close to 90% compliance, their ventilator-associated pneumonia rate decreases to zero, and that is zero for almost a year. A new technology is silver-coated endotracheal tubes. This is one study by Martin Colliff and colleagues from Washington University in Missouri, published in JAMA in 2008. Pretty well-designed study, prospective, randomized, single-blind, controlled study in 54 different centers, almost 10,000 patients, all of them adults, expected to require mechanical ventilation for at least 24 hours. They were randomized to either receiving the impregnated ET tube versus not. Ventilator-associated incidence was based on quantitative bronchoalveolar lavage cultures with greater than or equal to 10 to the 4 colony-forming units per ml, so pretty aggressive criteria for pneumonia. Patients were assigned to undergo intubation with 1 to 2 high-volume, low-pressure endotracheal tubes, similar except for the silver coating. The rates of microbiologically confirmed ventilator-associated pneumonia were lower in the silver group, 3.8 versus 4.8%. This was statistically significant. The silver-coated endotracheal tube was associated with delayed occurrence of ventilator-associated pneumonia, and that was statistically significant. There was no statistically significant difference between groups in the duration of intubation, duration of ICU stay, duration of hospital stay, mortality, or frequency and severity of adverse events. And they concluded that patients receiving silver coated endotracheal tubes had a statistically significant reduction in the incidence of ventilator-associated pneumonia and delayed onset of ventilator-associated pneumonia. A study done here in Europe, I think, was particularly enlightening and something that we certainly all need to think about. This was a study published in Journal of Hospital Infections last year of a survey of European intensive care unit nurses. It was a validated multiple-choice questionnaire that was distributed to 22 different countries between October 2006 and March of 2007. Over 3,000 questionnaires, response rate was pretty good, almost 70%. The average score of these ICU nurses was 45%. That meant they understood about 50% of what should or what should not be done. 55% knew that oral route is recommended for intubation. 35% knew that ventilator circuits should be changed with each new patient. 38% knew that heat and moisture exchangers were recommended type of humidifier, but only 21% knew that they need to be changed on a weekly basis. 46% recommended closed suctioning. 18% knew these must be changed with each new patient. 51% recognized subglottic secretion drainage, reduced ventilator-associated pneumonia. 57% recognize that kinetic beds reduced ventilator-associated pneumonia. So we have a lot of work to do. Even though we may know what to do, we need to make sure that our clinicians know what to do. So preventing ventilator-associated pneumonia, standard infection control practices, minimizing the duration or intensity of sedation, positioning the patient in a recombinant position, appropriate use of enteral feedings, antibiotics, and medical devices, use of sterile water for irrigation, closed suctioning, and mouth care. Last, let me hit on a subject that I know you've spent a great deal of time talking about during this meeting. This is from your health minister ordering targets that I know many of you were ecstatic about. I would point out that we're no different in the United States. If we look at just invasive MRSA, which is really blood culture positive MRSA, we have almost 19,000 deaths annually in the United States. That's more than die of HIV/AIDS, Parkinson's, homicides, injuries at work, and infant mortality. And I congratulate you and your government that at least is putting money into funding and trying to reduce these infections. Our government is putting very little in the United States. The recommendations for preventing MRSA are what I call active detection and isolation, doing a risk assessment to identify high-risk patients, active surveillance testing to identify the colonized reservoir, placing those patients in isolation or barrier precautions, hand hygiene, gown and glove use, and environmental cleaning. I want to point out two studies that I think kind of address one of the questions that Jillian raised. Are there any data to show that universal screening are worthwhile? This is a paper published by Robichek and colleagues last year in Annals of Internal Medicine, an observational prospective intervention study with universal screening. They didn't start at universal screening. They did a risk assessment and found it was a little bit of this, a little bit of that, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and they realized their nursing personnel would never be able to comply and have high rates of collecting the specimens, so they said, forget it, we'll just do everybody. So they did universal screening using MRSA PCR on all admissions at three different hospitals, 850 beds, over 40,000 admissions in Illinois. And they compared it with passive surveillance or clinical culture detection, targeted surveillance or high risk, which they defined as ICUs, and clinical culture, and then universal screening. And I'd point out the periods of these different periods. Passive was a year. Targeted screening was a year. And then universal screening was almost 2 years. They did nasal screening and placed positive patients in contact isolation. And unfortunately, it used decolonization with mupirocin. I don't have time to go through the entire study, but if you look at this, this is the initial time period where they used clinical cultures. This is when they did targeted screening, and this is when they did universal screening. And the bottom line is they had a 70% reduction in MRSA healthcare-associated infections. We have a system of hospitals throughout the United States, at least one in every state, called Veterans Administration Hospitals. And one of the hospitals in Pittsburgh had shown very significant reductions in MRSA in their surgical intensive care unit. As a result of that, the VA administration, which is a part of the federal government, said, we will begin ICU surveillance in every single VA hospital across the country. They started with, as I mentioned, high-risk surveillance. So their VHA-MRSA bundle was active testing, hand hygiene, contact isolation, and cultural transformation. We hear a lot about that. First it was Toyota Production System. Now the hot one is positive deviance. I would argue that I don't care if you use which one of these, even Six Sigma, that you use. It doesn't matter. I have not seen any of those that don't use ADI that have been successful. And I've seen ADI, or active detection of isolation, where they haven't used any of these that has been successful. I think cultural transformation is very helpful, and we should have administrators that are pushing that more, because we should have an intolerance to healthcare-associated infections than that they really are the only way that you can reduce such infections. If we look at their program, starting at the top from left to right, they provided both resources in terms of personnel and funding and equipment at all of their hospitals, and it took them about a year to get it into all of the hospitals across the country. And by the third year, they had a significant reduction in MRSA, and by the fourth year, they have almost a 50% reduction in MRSA in their ICUs. As a result of the impact that they were starting to see here, in particular here, they decided to expand it, and the VA system said, we're going to universal screening of all admissions. And boom, within 1 year, they had a significant reduction in MRSA. They now have moved it to their long-term or care homes, I think you would call them here. So virtually all of the care facilities at VA hospitals now are screening for MRSA. They have also seen a reduction in their antibiotic use, and as a result, a reduction in their C. difficile rate as well. There's one study I'd bring your attention to by Kleitman and colleagues that was at the Interscience Conference on Antimicrobial Agents and Chemotherapy last year, where they did a randomized controlled trial looking at if they identified Staph aureus, whether MSSA or MRSA in surgical patients, could it have an impact on infections? And they really looked, I want to look particularly at all nosocomial Staph aureus infections, and they were significantly reduced. If we look at endogenous, because you would think this would have an effect on endogenous, not exogenous infections, and indeed it did, significant reduction. And most importantly, if you look at these patients, the deep surgical infections that cost our hospitals so much money were significantly reduced. And there's been at least one study in the United States suggesting that if we screened all surgical patients, that we would save hundreds of lives, over 300,000 hospital days, and millions of dollars. So in conclusion, many, if not most, healthcare-associated infections are preventable with the implementation of simple evidence-based interventions. Implementation of evidence-based prevention interventions, including the latest technology, which may initially cost more money, but ultimately will save money, reduce infections, and save lives, should be a high priority for all of us in infection control. We should be seeking zero tolerance for healthcare-associated infections, and in some cases, we may even achieve on a monthly, many months, or even year basis, zero selected healthcare-associated infections. Thank you all very much.